I was in college a long time ago, there was all these, you know, like, it's ET or something, or TM or something, and it was like all these things were going on, and it was all new, and we didn't know what to do, and I remember going to some house, and everybody was sitting there, and I thought it, you know, I thought like it would be a very sacred moment in my life, you know, and I sat there, and they said, okay, now cross your legs, you know, I crossed my legs, and then they said, now close your eyes, you know, and I closed my eyes, and I was waiting for something to happen, you know, and I was like, and I tried really hard to see something black, you know, and that was about the level of the teaching in my, when I was in college, you know, and nobody knew what they were doing, and that was my first impression of meditation, you know, and I sat there for about half an hour and nothing happened, but I was waiting to see if anything would happen, and I didn't go back for like 5 years or something because it was kind of boring, so I think we have one disadvantage in this country is that since we're new Buddhists, that we got all this misinformation about meditation. You know, like we got little pieces of it came. It was that way in Tibet too. I mean, Buddhism first came into Tibet. All kinds of people showed up from India, and it was that way here, I think, in America. You know, like slowly people came. They started to talk about meditation. And it got better and better. And I think now we're at the stage, like in Tibet, they reached a stage where they got sophisticated enough that if people came from countries, certain countries, and said, meditation means thinking about nothing, they threw them out. You know, there was a famous debate between somebody named Hashang and somebody named Kamala Shila, and before the king, before the court of Tibet. And One person was saying you should just meditate on nothing and think about nothing, and they finally threw him out. They said no, that's not meditation, and they had like a vote among the in the court. This is like 800 AD, and just decided. So I think we're reaching that stage where you're getting sophisticated enough that you'll hear the authentic scriptures, and you'll find out what meditation is. The goal of meditation is very simple. And I think even that has been, there's a lot of misinformation or Dharma rumors, I call them, about the goal of meditation. In Buddhism, and we spoke about it last night, if you were there in San Francisco, the goal of meditation is not to just sit and be calm or something like that. You know, meditation is not, its ultimate purpose is not to be used to just make you calm, or somehow more, even more friendly, or something like that, or to deal with stress, or like that. It's a side effect. You get that. It comes. But it's not the goal of meditation. That's not what meditation is for. Meditation, and if you stay in this class after this next 5 minutes, what I'm working for, and what you should be working towards, the real goal of meditation, it's a tool. It's just a tool. It's not an end. It's a means. Okay? And it's meant to allow you to see into deeper kinds of reality, specifically emptiness. Okay, the ultimate goal of all Buddhist meditation is to reach a state where you can see emptiness directly. It takes years of training to get to that level of meditation, and you can get to that level of meditation and not see emptiness. You see what I mean? It's just an ability to concentrate deeply. And that's all that meditation means. When you think about meditation from now on, think about reading your favorite book. Think about seeing a really good movie. You know, my lama would flirt with me. You know, he has a TV. I don't have a TV. I would go up in his room. I lived with him for 20-something years. And he would be watching TV, and he'd say, sit down, you know. And he'd say, watch this. And there'd be some really interesting movie, and you'd be watching it. And then he'd be doing these mantras, but he'd be watching the movie. And then right when they find out who murdered the guy or something, he would turn it off. You know? I'd say, okay, now go to bed, you know. And I'd say, wait a minute, you know. This is my, you know, and I'd say, yeah, go. And that feeling you have when you're on the edge of your seat, you know, and you're like that, that's concentration. Meditation just means concentration. It's just a deep ability to concentrate. And you're like this, you know, and you're staring at it. Or you're reading a book and you're really into it and you finish 200 pages in one night and you look up, it's already like midnight or something like that. That's all concentration is. That's all meditation is. And we're going to talk about the difference between that state of mind and some kind of fuzzy state of mind, you know, some kind of spaced out state of mind that people get in when they cross their legs and close their eyes, you know? And that's not meditation. But I find myself, even now, you know, that sometimes the state of mind I'm in when I cross my legs and close my eyes is not the state of mind I have when I'm looking at a good movie, but it should be. You see what I mean? It's, you can call it bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. You know, it's like into it, you know. If you ever played music and you slobbered on your instrument, that's a sign of concentration. That means you're really into it. You're so into it, you're not remembering to close your mouth. You see what I mean? And it's something like that, and it's enjoyable. In its highest form, shamatha, is defined as Shinjangi Dewa Kepa Chengi Simbe, means you have a strong feeling of bliss from it, or pleasure from it, and that it should feel like that. It shouldn't be some dull, spaced out thing like that. Okay, that's not the point. What's the point of meditating? You get good at it. And only from that state of mind can you see emptiness directly. You cannot see emptiness directly unless you're in a very deep state of meditation. And if you never learn to meditate deeply, you will never see emptiness. We talked about it yesterday. There's emptiness as it is around you like air, like the air in this room. That might as well be emptiness. Think of emptiness as the air in this room. It's around you all the time. You've lived in it your whole life. Walking, sleeping, eating, pooping. You've been existing in a realm where emptiness is surrounding you, and you haven't seen it directly. It takes about 20 minutes to have the first direct experience of emptiness. It's called Tonglam Parchimilam. And if you see that, then very typically, I mean, anyone who's had that 20 minutes in the presence of direct perception of emptiness, you know your future enlightenment. You can perceive it. Right after that, you have all these experiences. In the same day you have these experiences, you're able to see the future. You're able to see the day of your enlightenment. You're able to see, you know that you have met the body of the Buddha. You have met the Dhammakaya, and you know that. You can read other people's minds. All of these things happen to you. You can see the details of your future lives, and you can see what's the day of your enlightenment, and you know what name they're going to call you and everything else. You see everything like that. And the purpose of meditation is to get to that point. If you're able to do that, just 20 minutes, everything is over. Your whole life is changed. They say there's two kinds of people in the world. Either you've seen emptiness directly or you haven't. And the whole universe, every living creature in the universe is put into one of those two categories. Once you've seen it directly, you're on your way out of here. No more suffering. Quickly you'll be in a place where there's no more suffering. Quickly you'll be able to stop all your negative emotions, which is nirvana. And then quickly you will become enlightened, and you can see that directly on that day. All you have to do, that's the power of emptiness. Emptiness has this power to do that. All you have to do is reach that place where you see that directly. And then you get some sort of, it's called deng. Deng means like written guarantee of everything. Everything becomes totally clear and positive, and you know what's going to happen forever in your life. You can see all of it. If you are on a bodhicitta track, you have an intense, direct experience of bodhicitta for the first time. Very powerful. And all of these things depend on seeing emptiness directly. And emptiness is all around you. All you have to do is do it once. And it has that power. Emptiness has that power. But you cannot do it if you're not in a deep state of meditation. It's totally, completely, 100% impossible. If you don't meditate daily, if you don't meditate an hour or 2 hours a day, and learn to, and I'm talking not about the preliminaries, I'm talking about in the state of deep meditation, you cannot see emptiness. It's impossible. And you will die in this life. If you see emptiness directly, even death can be overcome. Even that. So the stakes are very high. When I talk about meditation, okay, I'm not talking some kind of stress removal or peacefulness or even friendliness to other people, or I'm not talking about anything like that. You know, you cannot use meditation to remove physical pain, for example. It doesn't work. Okay? You cannot use meditation at the dentist's office like that. Those are Those are caused, pain like that is caused by other things. Meditation won't necessarily be very pleasant for a while. But your life is at stake. You see, I mean, the stakes are much higher than that, okay? You will get peaceful. You will get friendly. You know, you will see amazing things. I mean, if you really meditate properly, you can see your future lives, you can read other people's minds, you can do miracles. You can walk on water, you can change bricks into gold. It's not the point. It doesn't help you. You're still going to get old and die. The point is to use it as a tool to reach a place where you don't have to get old and die anymore. Okay, and that's the only reason to learn to meditate. It's a means to an end. So you have to get the end straight in your mind. You know, it'll also help you when you don't feel like meditating, if you remember that. Okay, and if you have a meditation when it doesn't go so well, because you don't feel so good, that's irrelevant. Okay, it doesn't matter. That's not the goal of meditation. I have many people, I say, how was your meditation today? They say, great. I say, why? And they say, oh, I had this chill up my spine, you know. I say, yeah, but did you see, you know, anything to do with emptiness? Did you understand anything? Did you have any insights? Oh, no, but it felt really good. I had a good meditation. You know, no, it doesn't have anything to do with it. It doesn't. That's not the point. A good meditation could be very painful physically. It's okay. The point is that you realize something and that you're able to go into deep concentration on something. And that's the idea of meditation. Meditation is, by the way, not something that you do in sessions. Okay, they're called tam and tun tam. The point is not that you just do meditation an hour a day or something like that. I'm talking about deep meditation and meditation posture. But to really meditate successfully, it's something that you do all day long. Okay, it applies to every part of your life. It's something that overflows into every part of your life. And this is, even in the tantric text, they're very adamant about it. That 1 or 2 hours overflows into your daily life. It changes the way you work. If you're interested in being a corporate success, you can be a corporate success because your concentration is intense. And it's good for everything you want to do. And then there's an osmosis, you know, it goes both ways. You have to be, what do you call that? One thing helps the other. Synergy. You know, and then when you're out of meditation, you behave in certain ways that support your meditation. You see what I mean? So while you're in meditation, obviously you're meditating. But when you're out of meditation, the skill of meditation is that in the other 22 hours of your day, you are undertaking a special way of life that makes you a better meditator. And so the meditation helps your life, and then the life helps the meditation. And if you think it's separate or you think that meditation ends when you get up, you'll never be a great meditator. It's a whole lifestyle is what I'm trying to say. And if it doesn't become a lifestyle, you won't succeed at it. And we're going to cover how to do, you know, all the sessions properly. And then we're going to flop over and talk about the lifestyle that you need to live to meditate properly. Because if you just meditate 2 hours a day and then you get angry at people, you don't keep your morality, and you eat too much, you won't be able to meditate when the time comes. They have to go together. You have to talk about your lifestyle as well as meditation. Okay. All the courses that we do, in New York we have like 15 courses like this, very strictly founded in the original text. So I like that you know this is not my presentation. You won't find anything written by me in those 15 courses. There's 3,000 pages of material there. It's all the original books, the original text. So I wanted to just list them for you. It's called Kung. Kung means authoritative sources. So you know that you're getting it from the horse's mouth. Okay? And this is not the most exciting part of the class. It's like listing books, okay? But I think it's important that you know that it's coming from very holy sources, okay? And not something I made up or something like that, okay? Can everybody see this board? Yeah? You want to move it back? Do you think we can move it back a little bit? I don't know. Would it work? How about back this way a little bit? This is fancy. When did you guys get this? Oh. Is that better? I'll try to stand in front of it as much as I can. You all right? Is it better over on that side? You'll just have to go like that. I can't move the pillar. Okay. Perhaps the most important source we'll use is this better? Can you see better here? Okay, we'll do it, darling. In Sarah, all the deadheads sit behind the pillars because the geeko can't see you, you know, if you fall asleep. And you won't get hit, you know. Ellie, do you have that thicker one, Ellie? The thick one? You have it? Thank you. I'm going to write the Tibetan, as I mentioned last night, the first Dalai Lama, in his famous, he wrote a very famous commentary on Abhidharma, and he uses all this Sanskrit, you know, and then he says, I have to use Sanskrit, because nobody thinks Tibetans know anything, so if I use Sanskrit, people think I know what I'm talking about, you know, so it's the same principle. Then he talks about merchants, barley merchants, who bag their barley in the bags that come from these special places in Tibet where the barley is better. And they take it from the plains and they bag it in the... Risul is like a special place where three mountains come together and the barley grows better. And he says, you have to package things right. Say Lamrim. Chemo. I'm going to ask you to repeat the Tibetan. Even if you never want to learn Tibetan, don't worry. About 10% of the people who think they don't want to learn Tibetan will probably be great translators. And that's the way it goes. So I just want to put a seed in your mind. So just say it loud and don't be shy. And no one's checking your pronunciation or anything like that. Say Lamrim.
Lamrim.
Chemo.
Lamrim.
Lamrim.
Chemo.
Lamrim Chemo is perhaps the greatest book ever written in Tibetan. Lam means path. Rim means steps or stages. And it's like Lamrim, when you say the word Lamrim, you should think of like an automobile repair manual where it says step one, step two, step three. That's all. I mean, people call it all sorts of weird things. All it means is like a toy. When you put a toy together, you get a little book there. It says, the first do this, second do this, third do that. I don't know what you... It's like an instruction book. That's all. And rim means step one, step two, step three. You know, just go through, stick this part on this part, then stick this part on this part. And if you go through it that way, then everything comes out fine. That's Lamrim. How to get to Buddhahood, how to get to enlightenment through, you know, 20 easy steps. That's Lamrim. Chemo means the great book on the steps of the path, okay? The great book on the steps of the path. And it was written by Jetsun Kapa. Sounds like somebody I know. He wants the dog treat. '1357-1419. Probably most famous for being the teacher of the first Dalai Lama, who was pretty young when Jetsun Kapa was old. They didn't stay together that long, but he wrote this book. And this is 1,000 pages. It's beautiful. His section on meditation is very, very great. And much of your reading will be from the Lamrim Chemo. They're working on it for a long time. But all the parts that you need are there. There is a translation. I think somebody's translated the first half and somebody translated the second half. I don't know if they're very good, but they're there. I think there's a good one being worked on now. And I believe Lama Geshe Sopa, he's been teaching it for 20 years and they've been doing transcripts, and I think that'll be really great when it comes out. Say Namdo, Lakchang. Namdo, Lakchang. Namdul means liberation. Refers either to nirvana or full enlightenment, which are not the same thing. Okay, but Namdul refers to both. Lak means your hand. And Chang means, the full name is Namdul Lak Chang Sikdupa. And it means a gift of liberation thrust into your hands. Like, here, take it. You know what I mean? And then it's been translated very wimpy as liberation in your hand or something like that. But it means like a gift of liberation, like thrust into your hands. Like the Lama comes and says, here, take it, you know, and you go, boom, and it's done, like that. And that's the real meaning of that title. I think the word in your hands in English sometimes means your responsibility, you know, I leave it in your hands. And I think sometimes the title might suggest that. It's not like that. The meaning of the title is, here, take it, you know. You know, put out your hand, and the Lama goes, you know, like that. That's Namdul Lakchang, Lakchang Sutupa. Okay? This is by Pabongka Rinpoche. He was born in 1878, passed away in 1941. He was the teacher of the Dalai Lama's teachers and of my root Lama. Very great book. I mean, if you had to pick one book in Tibetan that is most beneficial for Westerners, I think it's that book. And I think it's really good that they translated it and that it's sort of the unofficial Bible of the FPMT or something. To me, that would be the wisest choice you could ever make. So it's a great book on the whole stages of the path to enlightenment. It's very similar to the Lama Rinpoche, but he emphasizes different points. When Jetsun Kapa covers emptiness in great detail, Pabongka Rinpoche says, defers to Jetsun Kapa. When Jetsun Kapa doesn't cover the six preliminaries to meditation in great detail, Pabongka Rinpoche says, I'll take care of that. And he gives this huge presentation. So it's good to use them both. It's good to have them both together.
Okay.
Oh, boy. A lot of this comes from a book called... a great source for all of the teachings on meditation is the Gomrim. Say Gomrim.
Gomrim.
Gomrim. In Sanskrit, Bhavanakrama. Okay, Bhavanakrama. It was written in Sanskrit, translated into Tibetan. Master Kamala Shila was one of the two parties in that debate. He won, the other guy got kicked out of Tibet. Kamala Shila said, come on, you have to have content in your meditation. Your meditation should concentrate on something. You should focus on an object or a problem or an outline. But it's not that you sit there and try to think about nothing. And he was the winner of that debate, luckily, you know, so that became the standard for Tibet. And this is a huge text in the Tengyur. I believe it's two volumes. And he goes through all the stages of meditation. Rim means stages, like in Lam Rim, and Gom means meditation. Okay, we're going to go through all the Tibetan words for meditation. There's about 7 or 8 different words for meditation. I used to study Russian in college, and there were like 13 words for dark and foggy and depressing, you know. then when I hooked up with Tibetans, there were like 20 words for wisdom and 8 words for meditation, and we can't distinguish them very well in English. We only have the one word meditation. But I'm going to go through all the different flavors of words and different meanings and different ideas of meditation. I think you'll enjoy that. We'll do that today after we finish the sources.
Okay.
There's a practice that we're going to cover that's been called the seven limb puja or something like that, okay? Which is a mistranslation of yenlak, which means component or ingredient, okay? I like to call it the seven ingredients. Yenlak sometimes means a tree branch, and I don't know how it got translated as branch, but we're stuck with that. See how many we can get stuck with and how many we're not stuck with. Okay. That comes from an ancient book. You notice that we're going backwards. This is very typical. Okay? I mean, you go back. You start with your lineage lamas, then you work back to the Buddha. You know, you go back 2,500 years. Okay? Say Sangche.
Munlam.
Sangche. Manlam. Sangcha is a person, Sambochupa. His name is Samantabhadra. Okay? Samantabhadra. Samantabhadra. And he's a famous bodhisattva, and he made this incredible offering to the Buddha. Munlam means prayer, like the great prayer festival in Tibet is called Munlam Temo. And this is in the canon, in the Buddhist canon. And in there are the seven steps or the seven ingredients to how to do a proper preparation for meditation. So we'll be doing that also. There are other texts on the six preliminaries. I mean, it's not something that Tibetan lamas made up. They come from ancient India. They're 500 BC. And we'll go through the six preliminaries. The last text that we'll study, the last part, we'll talk about what are you supposed to meditate on. You see, it's one thing to talk about how to meditate, and then at the end you have to say, okay, go out and meditate. And the student should say, on what? You know, and then there should be something to meditate on. So there's a very powerful text which would be very typical to meditate on. It's also a very great text to use because it's a bridge between sutra and tantra. Okay, it's a bridge between the open teachings and the secret teachings. And this is called Yunden Shigyama. And if you're new, I don't want to overwhelm you with all this. It's not that important. All I want you to do is, you know, leave here with the impression that I know what I'm talking about, and that I'm using, authentic text. That's all. You don't have to memorize all this stuff. I mean, learn it for your homework and then forget it. Okay. That's Kirin, the diamond cutter boy. Say Yunden, Shir, Girma. Yunden, Shir, Kirma. Yunden means good qualities, good spiritual qualities, okay, like patience or meditation, okay. Shir means the foundation or the basis. It can also mean source, and in this case it means source, okay. Girma means you who are, okay, you who are the source of all my good qualities, meaning your lama. Because the first line of the text is Yunden Kungi Shigyur, you are the source of all good spiritual qualities. You know, if you are fortunate enough to live and stay close to a very qualified lama, they rub off on you, and every hour that you spend with them, they're rubbing off on you constantly, and you're learning things that you don't learn in class, and this is called Yunden Shigyurma. Just to be in their presence as much as you can is Yunden Shigyurma. And it's been translated as foundation of all good qualities or something like that, or source of all my good, something like that. This is a very beautiful, it was written by Jetsun Kapa. Most people don't know that it was actually a prayer that he spoke sitting in front of a statue of Lord Atisha in retreat at Rajang Monastery in 1402, okay? So he's like sitting in front of this statue. He hasn't met Lord Atisha. Atisha died, you know, 400 years before. And he's like praying for some kind of blessings from Lord Atisha. And it gets very, very intense. And he's praying and praying and praying. And he does a long prayer. The Yunden Shigyurma is only a little slice out of the middle, okay? And he does this long called Jinla Pung, something like that. Pungyur, which means mountain of blessings, okay? And the whole book is called that. And he's like praying and praying and praying, and he's praying. He's come to Rajang, which is one of the first monasteries in Tibet, to get some blessings from Atisha. And most people don't realize, Jetsun Kapa wrote how many pages of scripture? 10,000, okay? I mean, it takes us in the monastery, in the winter debates, we spend a month, about 12, 14 hours a day debating 25 pages, 50 pages. He wrote 10,000 pages. They say he was taking dictation from Manjushri. It's easy to believe, you know. But he spent half his time sitting in front of statues asking for blessings. You know what I mean? And this is a case where he's just sitting there in his cave asking for blessings. Then he goes into this hallucination that lasts for a month. He goes into it like an LSD trip that... off and on for a month. Like he's eating a little bit, drinking a little bit, and then he's back in this hallucination. And he's communing with all the lamas of the Lamrim lineage back to the Buddha. Like he's having this experience of being with them and talking with them. And this goes on for like a month. So this is a very beautiful. He comes out of that retreat, and his students say, "Do you think you could write down any of that stuff?" And he says, "Yeah, let's call it the Lamrim Chemo." And he goes into a cave and he knocks it out in like a short time. It's amazing, 1,000 pages, you know. And so this is a very important prayer. And it contains the entire contents of the Lamrim Chemo. In 14 verses or something, the entire Buddhist path from beginning to end. So this would be an appropriate meditation object. And that's what we're going to do. At the end of the class, we'll work on that, okay, as a meditation object. Okay, like somebody says, do a Lamrim meditation, and you're like, it's 1,000 pages long, you know, what am I supposed to meditate on? Yinnin Chigirma contains the whole Lamrim, and Jetsun Kapa said so, and he wrote the Lamrim Chimma. So that's enough. Okay. All right. So that's what we'll be, that will be the source for our meditation object, because you need a meditation object. Okay. We're going to cover 5 major subjects in this class, and I just want you to know what the subjects are going to be. Okay. The first one is how to get ready to meditate. Meditation, if you've ever done any kind of serious exercise, which I did many years ago, okay, that's it. It's like weightlifting or running or anything like that. You must warm up before you start meditating. It's a disaster to, you know, be at the office, be screaming at some supplier on the phone, you know, come home in a traffic jam, get into your house, burst into your house, and sit down on your cushion, you know. It doesn't work. I mean, you may have noticed. Lama Yeshe said, first sit on your couch, lay down on your couch and have a coffee and think about all living beings, you know. He used to say that. I heard. I didn't have the pleasure of taking teachings from him, but I did. He came and visited my Lama and we talked some. So it's very important to get ready to meditate properly, okay. There's steps that you take after you sit down or just before you sit down, and then there's kind of steps that you take your whole life, okay? Your whole 22 hours before you go into and sit down on your meditation cushion. So there's two stages there that we're going to talk about, how to get ready. The main component here is called the 6 preliminaries. I've had a lot of Americans come to me, you know, you guys are of the age, and I'm of the age where, you know, you've been trying to do it, many of us, for 5 years, 10 years, 15 years. And then some people come to me and say, look, I've been trying to meditate for 5 years, off and on. And I didn't have any deep religious experiences, you know, like, I enjoy it. I do it fairly regularly. I've reached a point where my breathing is good and I'm able to concentrate fairly well. But I can't claim that I've had any, you know, amazing... And, you know, once I thought I saw this green halo thing or something, but and I might have had, you know, I'm not sure if I was falling asleep or it was a little glimpse of emptiness or something like that. You know what I mean? And I hear that often. And but I didn't have like a confirmable deep religious experience. You know, it didn't happen to me. And then I normally question them about their warm up. You see. Did you do your warm-up? You know, are you preparing well for your meditation before you meditate? And then they say, I never heard of that. You know, and this is taught by Lord Buddha. This is in the Kangya. There are texts called the 6 preliminaries. In 2,500 years ago, taught by the Buddha. And you probably can't meditate successfully without knowing them. And then I have other friends who have studied Lamrim with great lamas, and they say, oh yeah, I heard about those preliminary things, and I do about 3 of them. And but usually I don't have time because I wake up late. I got to get to work, you know. And the kids are starting to wake up, you know. And then I say, well, what do you expect? You know, it's like it's very similar to trying to run a short race, you know, like a 50-yard dash without warming up. It's very similar, and you'll get very similar results. Okay, and I'm not kidding. It's just like that, you know, to get up cold and try to run a very short, intense race. You'll just hurt yourself or it won't work out. And meditation is exactly the same. Don't think it's any different. You must prepare the scene properly. in the half hour or before you start to meditate, there has to be a certain regimen that you go through, that you warm up very properly. It's like stretching all the muscles properly, and then you go, you slide into meditation. You know what I mean? And it's very smooth and very organic, and then it goes very well. And then there's whole lifestyle things that you could do for the whole time you're out of meditation, so that when you get into your meditation room, your mind and your body are totally ready to meditate. Okay, so we're going to talk about the preliminaries or preparation for meditation in both of those terms. What do you do in the few minutes before you meditate, and then what do you do the whole rest of your life to make sure that your body and your mind are very, very ready to meditate. Okay, and you have to do both of those. You have to cover both of those. We'll spend two classes on that. Okay. 10 classes total, right? Yeah. Okay. Second one. Say, shine.
Shine.
Sokten.
Shine.
Sokten.
Shine
is a very high form of meditation, very high form of concentration. We'll talk about it. In Sanskrit, shamatha. I don't know where they got the shamatha thing and or tha. We'll talk about it. Anyway, Shamatha. Shi means peace. Ne means to stay in peace. It's deceptive, okay? It doesn't mean to sit there and be friendly or something like that. It means to... the definition of shine is that you reach an incredibly deep point of meditation which is imbued with physical and mental pleasure. Okay? And that's the definition of shine. It's the highest form of one-pointed mind. And we'll talk about the difference between one-pointed mind and shamatha and dhyana and bhavana and all these different kinds of meditation. Okay, in English, we have one word, meditation. Okay, tsok means, you know tsok in the meaning of a prayer or an assembly, like we're doing a tsok tonight. But the literal meaning of tsok is for many things to gather together. So this means to fit all the necessary components of the environment, the meditating environment, you know, mental, physical, and geographic environment in which you should meditate. Okay, preparing the environment so that the meditation goes well. The first of those, obviously, is getting the right place to meditate, you know, making sure you have a conducive atmosphere, the ambiance of the place to meditate properly. And then there are other components of that, but it's how to set the environment around you. Den means, it's a difficult word meaning to utilize or to get ready, or to, here we could say, setting the environment, okay? Getting your environment right, ready, okay? We'll spend the third and fourth classes on that, okay? The third part of the class will concentrate on, you know, physically, how are you supposed to sit? You know, are you supposed to keep your eyes open or not? You know, should you have your head laying on your shoulder or not? You know, can I be a meditator if I have to sit in a chair? And you can, okay? And we'll go through all of those things, you know. What is the traditional physical posture? Again, this has come from ancient times. This was taught by the Buddha. It's called Namnangi Chunun. Say Namnang
Chudun.
Namnang
Chudun.
Namnang is one of the five... one of the members of the five Buddha families, Bairochana. This is like it's one of the five classic Buddhas. They're called Dhyani Buddhas. I have no idea why. I've been studying it for a couple of days. I can't see anywhere. I don't know why. Maybe something to do with meditation. I don't know. But in the text, Bairochana is important for posture because this Buddha represents the physical purity of the Buddhas emanating as an angel, emanating as a living being. Okay, so if you took all the total purity of a Buddha's physical body, okay, they don't have any arthritis, they don't have any backaches, they're physically perfect. They are made of light. Their bodies don't have any inner organs, for example. They don't have poo-poo or pee-pee. They're totally, physically, they are absolutely perfect. And if you took that physical perfection and put it into the form of a living being, that's what Vairochana is. So the posture is called the posture of Vairochana, okay, for that reason. Okay, that's why it's called the posture of this Buddha. Okay, the Buddha's name means appearances, and it refers to the ability of this Buddha and all Buddhas to appear any way they want, anywhere they want, anytime they want. Okay, what I mean? That's why this Buddha is called appearances, because he can appear as your next door neighbor for 20 years, just so that on Saturday morning they can say something to you and trigger some thought in your mind. And Buddhas are very patient. You know, 20 years is nothing in the lifetime of an omniscient being. So they could move next door to you and live there for 20 years and appear to be a normal guy. That's his name, right? Appearances. And then pop something on you just to test you or just to push you a little further along a spiritual path. And in fact, all the people in your life could be like that. It's Truman's Show all over again, okay? Truman's Show is profound. If you haven't seen it, you should see it. It's exactly like that. And they're very patient. You know, they could be born as your kid, grow up, and then suddenly one day do something to you. And no problem for them. Totally normal activity for them, okay? That's what Vairochana means. That's what the name Vairochana means, the ability to appear. Cha means characteristics of meditation. Normally it means dharma. Here it means posture, okay? Dun means seven. Seven points of a correct meditation posture. There are seven details about your body for a correct meditation posture. Oftentimes we add another one, which is counting the breath, and we'll be doing that. Oftentimes they call it the eight by adding the counting the breath, okay? So sometimes you hear the seven-point posture of Vairochana, and then sometimes you'll see the eight-point posture, which is the addition of the breath, which comes from the Abhidharma, Vasubandhu. I think it's the sixth chapter.
Okay.
Or seventh chapter. Say Gomtsu.
Gomtsu.
That's the guts of the course, okay? How to actually do it, you know, while you're in meditation, what are you supposed to think about? And this comes in three parts, okay? Galupas love divisions and to number things, and, you know, that's what we do. Okay, three parts to how to meditate properly. First one is called the five problems of meditation, called Nyepanga, okay? So you have to, if you're going to be a good meditator, you have to know the enemy. And you have to be able to recognize the enemy when the enemy comes. And some of the things you think are enemies are not, and many of the things you think are great meditation are enemies, okay? And you have to learn to, it's called dangi chepa, means you have to learn to tell the wheat from the chaff. You know, you have to be able to distinguish between what's a problem in your meditation and what's a good thing in your meditation. And many of the things you think are, when you say, oh, I had a good meditation today, Jetson Kapa would say, yeah, about half of it was spent in subtle dullness, you stupid head. You know what I mean? You know, you have to learn to identify very subtle problems of meditation, and they're difficult because they appear to be good meditation, you see? So you have to learn the very subtle enemies of meditation. So there are five problems, typical problems of meditation. Then there are eight fixes for those five problems. There are eight actions that you undertake. There are eight ways of battling the five problems, okay? If you learn to identify the five problems, if you get good at using these eight medicines to fix them, okay, then you reach nine different mental states, which is called semnegu. So the subject we're going to talk about is problems of meditation, and then weapons you can use to stop those problems, and then states of mind that you will reach. And this is very, very important. It's like a roadmap. You know, somebody come up to you and say, how's your meditation? Say, I'm on level 3. And you know what level 3 means. And you know how to stay there. And you know why you got there. You see what I mean? And it's not just this fuzzy thing that goes on for 10 years, and then at the end of 10 years, you can honestly say, I'm not much better than I was when I started, you know, I don't know. It's very great to know what are the problems, to know how to attack them, and then to know how to judge your progress. Oh, I'm on level 3 now. And I commonly meet Americans who who think they reach shamatha. You know what I mean? It's like, if you think you reach shamatha, that's like saying, I think I reached the Olympics, you know? You know what I mean? It's as silly as that. I mean, you would know it, okay? Because you would have worked on it for 5 years intensely. You know, it's like saying, I think I won a gold medal in the Olympics, but I'm not quite sure, you know? It's like silly, you know, it's like crazy. So you have to know how to tell where you are, okay? And that'll be the subject of Gomtso. Okay? The last subject, then we'll take a break, okay? Say Gomyo.
Gomyo.
Gom means meditation. Yul means the object of your meditation. What are you going to meditate about? Okay? It's not enough to have a big gun. You have to have a target. Okay? Meditation is the big gun. You know, good meditation is 357, you know. And then often, very often in this country, people don't know what they're supposed to shoot with it. You see what I mean? They don't know what they're supposed to focus it on. It's very common to see in this country somebody teach meditation for weeks or months and then not tell people what to meditate about. It's not just thinking about nothing, okay? This is, even in 800 AD, was clearly identified as the biggest mistake you can make in meditation, you know? If you think that it's useful to sit there for 2 hours and try to think about nothing, you know, I said last night that all the kids in my high school that used to space out in the back, they'd all be enlightened by now, you know what I mean? They did that and it didn't work, it didn't do anything, you know what I mean? So that's a very grave error, and it's a very grave error to teach that to people. Just sitting there and trying to think about nothing is trying not to think. As the lady said, she answered the question last night. It's a contradiction of terms, you know, because you have to think not to think, you know, and you can't. It's clearly stated throughout thousands of Buddhist scriptures that Buddhists think, and they think about things, you know, and they think about how to help you and what to do and everything else. I mean, your mind has, according to Buddhism, has no beginning and has no end. You will be thinking forever. So you might as well give up that, all right? Okay. And the idea is to make the thinking more and more pure and more happy and more profound and deep, you know. It doesn't, by the way, mean that you have to think thoughts in the sense of conceptual thoughts. I'm not saying that. You know, Buddhas are in a state of mind where they have kind of thinking, but it's not like the kind of mental conversations we have. It's similar to that. And it's not like they're thinking about nothing or their mind's on some big black hole or something like that. It's not like that. They have an intense awareness of all objects in the universe. So they're thinking in a way. Things are in their mind. And to think that you can empty your mind or think about nothing is a grave mistake in meditation. People have risen through the centuries to try to propose that, and then the good Buddhists have been trying to, you know, to get them to stop that, you know, it's been a problem throughout history. It doesn't mean that in a deep state of meditation, it might not feel like similar to that, but you're still thinking if you're meditating. You can't turn your mind off like that. It's not taught like that. So you must have an object of meditation, and the object should be something important, something holy, something sacred, something that will make you free, and that's emptiness. Okay, you have to try to reach that. And emptiness and thinking about nothing are absolutely not the same thing. No connection, no relation, nothing like that, okay? So we'll talk last about what to meditate about. I'd like to take a break now. When you get back, we'll talk about the different flavors of meditation. It's not quite 31, but it's close, all right? So take a 10-minute break and come back, okay? We're going to go through all the different words for meditation. It used to drive me crazy. You know, somebody says shamatha, somebody says vipassana, somebody says vipassana, somebody says samatha, somebody says dhyani, you know. All these words, all these ideas, and I thought you'd like to know the specific meaning of each of them. And then you can, in the future, you can divide them. You know what I mean? You can say, oh, that one's that kind, that one's that kind. Okay? Say Gomba.
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 This is not the word for temple, okay? That's really Gomba, and it's a different spelling. So this is not the same thing, okay? This Gomba means to meditate, and this is the most general word in Tibetan for meditation called Gomba, okay? It's kind of a neat word because the word kom means to get used to something, okay? So it comes from a meaning of getting used to something or becoming, getting into a habit. It's called komba. And the idea is that in good meditation, you keep going over the same pattern in your mind and you keep repeating. For example, if you're doing a Lam Rim meditation, which is one kind of meditation, you repeat a certain series of things in your mind again and again until it becomes like a, they call it a neural pathway or something. I mean, they say, oh, kids should learn foreign languages because they make connections that they don't make otherwise somewhere in their mind, you know. I don't know exactly how that works, but I have the feeling it's something similar. Gomba means you get, for example, if you're meditating on a picture of a Buddha or on a Buddha image, that you do it so often that it gets burned into your consciousness, it gets burned into your mind. And that's called gomba. That's the root meaning of gomba. So the Tibetan word for meditation, the most general word, means to repeat a visualization or a series of thoughts constantly until it's burned into your mind and it becomes part of your mind. And that's gomba, okay? Say samten.
Samten.
Samten. Oh, by the way, this one in Sanskrit is, what is that? I'm giving you Sanskrit just so we can distinguish between all those Sanskrit ones. Okay. Now I can't see. Okay. I don't know. We'll work it out. I'll tell you what, in the break, Michael, stick it where you're going to have it, and then everybody arrange themselves accordingly when they sit down. How's that? Okay. So Sanskrit bhavana, for gomba, general word for meditation. For example, Kamala Shila's classic source on how to meditate is called Bhavana Krama, the rimbas or the stages or the steps to how to meditate. Okay. Samten in Sanskrit, what is that, Dhyana? Sam means to think. Ten means firm or stable. And there are two kinds of samtens you can think about. You'll see the word samten twice. When you list the six bodhisattva perfections, okay, the six perfect activities, meaning leading to perfection of a bodhisattva, the parotachimbas or the paramitas, the fifth one is called samten, okay? And in that case, it just means meditation. Or concentration, the ability to meditate. Okay, so when we say gom gyat, it means hey, you've been doing your meditation. And when we say samten, the feeling you get if you know Tibetan is they're talking about the perfection of samten. You know how the bodhisattvas meditate like that. Okay, in the context of the six perfections. So in that way, gomba is a little bit different from samten. Gomba is a general word for meditating, and it's the colloquial word. You know, they say what are you up to? They say gom gyagyore. Okay, I'm doing meditation. Okay, but samten is a more formal word, and it most often refers to the fifth perfection. Okay, there's a whole different samten, a whole different kind of samten, which is four levels of meditation that you can do in this life, and we call them causal meditation. Causal means if you get good at that kind of meditation, you will take a rebirth in a certain kind of realm. Okay? So samten also means that. There are four levels. We say samten dambo, samten nyipa, samten sumba, samten shipa. And these are four different levels of meditation that if you spent a lot of time doing them, then you would be reborn in a certain very pleasant place for a while. Okay? And it's considered like a not a very good thing to do. You know, like a waste of time. It's like taking a long vacation and then coming back to a really lousy place. So it can mean, samten can mean one of those four kinds of meditation. The place where you're born if you do one of those four is called the form realm. And this is a very, very subtle place. It's not like the world we live in. And people have a very, very subtle bodies and they have very, very blissed out minds for a while. And it's considered a sort of a waste of time in Buddhist practice. Okay, So that the birth that you take is very similar to the meditation you were in your whole life. If you're in India and you practice in some ashram and you do this for year after year after year of meditation on nothing, you know, trying to stop your thoughts or thinking that you're stopping your thoughts, then that would be a cause to be reborn in the form realm. And then that you would be born in a place where people are kind of mellow and their minds are very mellow. It's sort of like California. And no. That's a New Yorker's perception, California. Okay. But you would just kind of be mellow for a long time, and then they say you normally go to a hell realm or something. I mean, you wear out your good karma and in that place, and then you go to a lower realm. So it's not like a goal. So the second meaning of samten in scripture is one of those four meditation levels, that if you do them seriously, they would cause you to be born in the form realm. That meaning is important for people who want to see emptiness directly. Why? You have to get up to that state of the first samten to be able to see emptiness directly. You have to be able to put your mind into that meditation level if you want to see emptiness directly. So it's the same level that someone would be in that would make them be reborn into the first part of the form realm, the lowest part of the form realm. So actually, when you see emptiness directly, the state of meditation you're in is not even in this world. Okay? I mean, mentally, you are no longer in this world that you and I know. Your senses, sense of sight, hearing, smell, taste, and feeling, are shut down. You cannot hear anything, you cannot see anything, you cannot smell. Somebody could be cooking McDonald's French fries next to you and you wouldn't smell anything. Okay, I mean, the concentration would be that intense. Samten dambo nyedo micho me. It's a specific level within that level, within one of those levels. It's called samten dambo nyedo micho me. It's a very specific platform from which you can, only from this platform can you see emptiness directly. And it's a form of shamatha. Okay, so you must be able to reach that platform and stay there. You can reach that platform, and if you don't focus in on something meaningful, you'll be born in the form realm, and you waste your time. You have to be able to reach that platform, and only from that platform can you see emptiness directly. And all Buddhist scripture says the same thing, from Abhidharma up to Madhyamika. They say you must be able to reach samten dambo nyedo micho me. Let's say it just for it's auspicious, okay? Samten dambo nyedo micho me. Okay, and it's one like preparatory level of the first samten, the first causal. We call it causal meditation because if you stayed in that your whole life and didn't do anything else, like you didn't think about emptiness, you would be born, and it would cause you to be born into the form realm. Okay, that's the second meaning of samten. So now you know two meanings of dhyana or samten. Okay, third word for meditation. Say nyomju.
Nyomju.
Nyom means like somehow level, okay? Like nyombur is the Tibetan word for a plane that levels out the wood. I mean, the bumps are sticking up and you nyomba it and it takes off all the burlen, it's called. Bur means it's onomatopoeia, right? It means a bump. And len means a taker offer. So a burlen is a plane and it makes things nyomba. It makes them, so nyomba means like evil, equal. Juk means to go into that state of meditation. So nyomjuk, you know, good luck translating these things differently from one another. I don't know. That's your problem, okay? But nyomjuk means some kind of meditation that stresses the fact that your mind is on a very even keel, okay? There's a couple of kinds of nyomjuk. And these are treated in the Abhidharma Kosha. The Abhidharma gets into the different states of meditation towards the end. One is called Dushe Mebe Nyomjuk. Say Dushe Mebe Nyomjuk. Dushe Mebe Nyomjuk. This is a kind of meditation where you try not to have many thoughts, you know, and it's a mistake. Okay, Dushe Mebe Nyomjuk. Literally, Dushe means the ability to discriminate between two things. This is good, this is bad, this is high, this is low, this is red, this is blue. In a Dushe Mepe Nyomjuk state, your ability to make those distinctions is leveled out. And it's a mistake. It's not considered a good meditation. Okay? It's like you can't tell the difference between things anymore. It's like being on heroin or something. Okay? Very similar. And it's just this kind of buzzed out state where you can't tell the difference between things anymore. Okay? And there's the name of it is the meditation where you have no ability to make discriminations. And then there's this huge debate in the Abhidhamma. Do you really not have any ability to discriminate? And they say, well, you have a very, very subtle one. You know, like it's like Mike Tyson punches you and knocks you out or bites your ear off or something. And you're on the ground and you can't think of anything. You're unconscious. But in Buddhism, we say you still have some consciousness going on or else you would die. You see what I mean? Some level of mental activity is taken. Maybe you're dreaming about, you know, getting hit by a truck or something. But some kind of mental activity is going on, even in deep nyomjuk. Okay, another kind of nyomjuk is called gopen nyomjuk, and that's in Abhidharma. That's a kind of meditation on emptiness. Okay, so nyomjuk doesn't have to be bad. Some of them are, some of them aren't. But it's a kind of meditation. Okay, it's one more kind of meditation, and that's where you hear about it, mostly in the Abhidharma. Okay. Oh, the Sanskrit word for that. Salmon patty, samapati. Okay, sama means like all the same, and patti means engaged in that kind of meditation. Okay. Why did the Buddha teach people to do that kind of meditation if it wasn't useful? Why did the Buddha teach the Abhidharma if it's not all correct? Yeah, it was that what level they were on. You know, they were attracted to that, you know. If you have a student who's attracted to that and would leave you if you started talking about the higher kinds of meditation, then you have to you lead them on. And this is a quality of a Buddha. They do that. They come down to your level, you know. They appear as Lama Sopa rather than a tantric deity. You see what I mean? Because you couldn't handle it. If you disrespected tantric deity, it'd be really bad. You can kind of get away with disrespecting Lama Sopa. You see what I mean? So, I mean, if they really appeared, if His Holiness appeared as this blazing white light, you know, Avalokiteshvara, I mean, everybody have to buy sunglasses or something. You know what I mean? They can't appear in their true form for us. They have to come down to our level. And in fact, that's going to be the last course in New York, is in October. It's called the Art of Interpretation called Chang'e. How do you know when the Buddha was giving the ultimate presentation? How do you know when he was just trying to make it easy? You see, His Holiness is good at that. When he gives a public lecture to 5,000 people, he can't go into the fine points of emptiness. He has to make it understandable. And some of what he says may not be strictly technically correct, but it's important to present it that way. And the Buddha was very good at it. And that's why there's four schools of Indian Buddhism. Three of them are not technically correct, but they're useful for bringing people up to a higher level. And they're important. And you have to be able to use them, and you have to be able to teach them. And we call it your toolbox in Tibetan. You have to have a good toolbox. You have to know all the kinds of presentations that might help somebody. To lead them, to keep them going up, 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 you know. So you have to be able to relate to people on a basic level. That's what Abhidharma is. And that's why the Buddha taught these nyomjuks, okay? Next one. Yeah. Shamatha, okay? Shamatha. And in Tibetan, Shine, Shine, okay? Shine. This poor word has been abused, the idea has been abused, like so many. It's been called shamatha and samatha and, you know, anyway, the correct pronunciation is in Sanskrit is shamatha. And she does mean quiet, and ne does mean to stay. But it's only metaphoric to call it calm abiding or something like that. It's nothing about calmness about it, nothing to do with calmness. Nothing to do with abiding. You know what I mean? It's a metaphor. It doesn't have anything to do with being calm or something like that. Nothing to do with that. The definition of shamatha is intense single-pointed concentration imbued with physical and mental pleasure from the meditation. Okay? And it's a bodhisattva vow not to mistake the... You guys did bodhisattva. We did a whole course. Come on. Yeah. It's a bodhisattva vow that you are not to mistake the pleasure for an important spiritual attainment. Okay? It's a side product. It's a byproduct. Sorry, you can't get out of it, you know? But it's not a goal in itself. Why? I mean, you'll sit there and feel good and die. Okay? It's no use, you know? I've met many, many... go look up the great meditators of certain traditions, and they just got old and died. You see what I mean? What's the point? You know, at a certain age, your back gets bad. It doesn't matter. Your hips go. Your knees go. Okay? It's no use to sit there for 10 years or 15 years or however many years you have before you reach that and feel calm. You know, it's not the point. It's to use that intense concentration to see emptiness, which does get you out of suffering, which does stop your body from dying. Okay? You have to do that. But it's not the point to sit there and be calm or something. I don't like that translation. I don't know what we're going to call it, but it's just an intense concentration. The level of meditation with which you see emptiness can be called shamatha. But you can also be a non-Buddhist and have shamatha. You see? Shamatha focused on emptiness directly would make you a very, very high-level Buddhist automatically. You see what I mean? But you can be a person who's using shamatha on money, for example, or on food, or on objects like that. You see what I mean? It's just an intense form of concentration. When you link it with a thing called vipassana, which is an intense understanding of emptiness, then those two together are the direct perception of emptiness. Okay? So, and vipassana, which in Pali is vipassana, has been, in America, people have come to think of it as meditation. It has nothing to do with shamatha. You see what I mean? Shamatha is the meditative state of mind. Vipassana is an understanding of emptiness. And when you say you have to combine shamatha with vipassana, it means you have to combine the ability to meditate with content of the meditation, meaning emptiness. Vipassana refers to a deep understanding and perception of emptiness. It has nothing to do with the meditation. You see what I mean? So that's been a dharma, that's been sort of a misnomer, I think, that we've come to associate vipassana, which is the Pali, with meditation. You see, it's not. The meditation is shamatha, and the content of the meditation when you're perceiving emptiness is called vipassana in Sanskrit and vipassana in Pali. Okay? So that's a misnomer. We have this really cute chart. You've seen it probably, of the elephant and the rabbit, and they represent different mistakes in meditation. And you go up this long and winding road, and finally, we're going to try to get it translated and published for you by the time we finish the course. Okay? We have one that was done by Tijang Rinpoche, that which would be very cool. So we're going to translate it for you, and I think Maya's going to do that after she finishes the other four projects. Okay. If you can't see it, it says Tingen Zin, and the Sanskrit is Samadhi. Okay, Samadhi, S-A-M-A-D-H-I. Okay. I like this word. Say Tingen
Zin.
Tingen
Zin.
The Sanskrit Sama means, you know, like to be equal or level. Di means to think. And again, it's a kind of meditation. The Tibetans translate it as Tingen Zin. Tinge means... Tinge is like Lo Ting Ting means deep, beautiful spring green. You see, it means a vibrant color. You know, and that's that state of mind, the movie state of mind or the good novel state of mind, you know. It's like when you're like, you know, that's called Tinge. Okay, and Tingen Zin means to maintain that vibrant state of mind. Okay. This is defined. I'm going to write the definition for you. If you can't see it, it says sem, se, say again, sem, se, chikpa, sem, se, chikpa. Okay. I'll give you a moment to write it. Okay. S-E-M, T-S-E, C-H-I-K-P-A. Okay. Sem means mind in Tibetan. Okay. Tse means point, like the tip of your finger is called a tse. Tip of your tongue is called a tse. Okay. And chikpa means single. So the definition of Dingen Zen is single-pointed mind, single-pointed concentration. I used to go crazy about this, you know, like I left my old religion because I wasn't satisfied with the precision, the lack of precision. And then I got to Tibetan Buddhism and everyone's talking about single-pointed mind and I'm like seeing cone heads, right? You know, like I'm like, what's a single-pointed mind, you know? You know, what does it mean to be single-pointed mind, you know? And then I was digging around in scripture and I finally came to a place that says single-pointed concentration means single-object concentration. And that's all, okay? The point means one thing that you're focusing on. My boss has Dingen Zen. I always tell the story, we went to Japan. He's like a multimillionaire, you know? We started this company. He makes $100 million. He sells $125 million a year. He's Semtse Chikpa, single-pointed concentration. We went to Japan for business. He didn't eat for 18 hours. He didn't drink anything for 18 hours. You know, concentrated totally on money, you know, and making money. And then finally he said, let's go to a restaurant. And there were four of us with him, and we were all like, oh, thank you, you know. And he goes to the restaurant. This is Okura Hotel in Tokyo. And the lady says, what would you like? And we're like looking at the menu, and he says, we'll all take coffee. And then he drank a coffee, and he ate all the sugar packets. And then he said, let's go, you know. And this is like Semtse Chikpa. It's single-pointed mind. You see, it doesn't have to be on a virtuous object, okay? It can be on anything, but it should be one single thing. Like, he doesn't think about his kids. He doesn't think about his wife, literally. You know, he doesn't think about his appearance, even. He doesn't even think about using the money. You see what I mean? He has all this, and he doesn't use it, but he's single-pointed concentration on making it. You see what I mean? And that's Semtse Chikpa. That's Dingen Zen, okay? It could be on anything, and that in Sanskrit is called samadhi. Okay, samadhi. Okay. Last one, and then we'll finish. Well, we have a little bit after that. Actually, I think we will finish with this one, okay? You don't have to do your last homework question. We'll cover it in the next class, okay? So between now and the next class, you can skip the last one, okay? Because we're going to cover it in great detail this afternoon. This is called Nyamshat, okay? N-Y-A-M-S-H-A-K. Nyamshat. Say Nyamshat.
Nyamshat.
Nyamshat. Okay. The Sanskrit, I had to look it up, I never heard it, but anyway, is samahita. They seem to all have the word sama, meaning equal, or, okay? Nyam means equal, okay? Nyam, nyamba means equal. Shak means to be staying in that state, like remaining in that state, okay? Nyamshat. Oftentimes with Nyomjuk and Nyamshak, which are similar, right? They sound similar, Nyomjuk and Nyamshak. The idea of equilibrium is important. That translation is good, okay? Like, I pick on a lot of translations. I like that one. Equilibrium means there are two extremes in meditation. There are two states that you're trying to avoid in meditation. And the whole point of meditation is to draw a path through the two extremes. It's like walking through two lines of enemies, you know, and the idea is to keep going down the middle and not to bump into either line on the other side. I compare it to driving. If you watch any kind of driver, they're constantly correcting all the time. You know, first you correct to the left, and then it's too far, and then you correct to the right, and it goes. It's not like you hold the wheel steady and go down the middle. It's not like that. You keep correcting to one side until it goes too far, and then you keep correcting to the other side. That's the idea of Nyamshak and Nyomjuk, and all good meditation is a constant correction. There's a poem by Gerard Manley Hopkins called The Windhover, and it's very beautiful. And it's about, you know, that when you look up at this bird in the sky, it looks like he's effortlessly gliding, you know, and then he's not expending any effort at all. But if you could go up there and be with him, he's like, you know, he's constantly doing this, and it takes great effort and skill to keep correcting and keep staying in equilibrium. And that's the idea of Nyomjuk or Nyamshak, is staying in the middle, staying in equilibrium. Between one and what? One extreme is called Chingwa. Say Chingwa.
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 And we're going to study it in detail. Chingwa is one of the greatest enemies of meditation. Dullness. Spacing out. Okay? I'd say probably 80% of Americans who close their eyes and sit there in a warm room with a hamburger in their stomach get into Chingwa quickly. And the irony and the danger is that it feels good. And if you can sit there for a couple hours without moving, it's very possible that you have Chingwa. And Jetsun Kapa was a devoted enemy of Chingwa. You know, he went around teaching people how to recognize Chingwa and how to know when you've slid into Chingwa. You see what I mean? So Chingwa is like some kind of dullness of mind where you're just kind of spacing out.